How's it going, everybody? We're back with another edition of the Ad Podcast. And today I have an awesome guest for you. Eric Brownstein is the co-president and partner at Shareability, one of the world's most viral branded content studios and a social strategist agency for massive brands like Google, YouTube, and Mars. And they also have the distinguished honor of having the most shared ad ever, which is pretty wild, the most shared PSA, and the number one most shared music branded music video. So these guys know a thing or two about how to reverse engineer virality. And Eric and I go way back. We were colleagues before when we were first kind of exploring these concepts of branded content meets paid media. And how do you go out there? And, you know, we never like to say we can guarantee a video can go viral, but I think if you work with a shop like Eric's, you probably will have the best possible chance. So for that being said, Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me on, you know, appreciate it.
Yeah, let's do it. Cool. Well, cool. Well, hey, you know, I got into a little bit of it, but you, I think what I loved about doing the research on you, and some of this I probably knew, and some of this was a bit of a refresher, even, you know, predating the time that you and I used to work together. You have talked a little bit about having people that were willing to take a chance on you at different points in your life because you have a non-traditional career path. I think I would probably put myself in that same bucket. I went to film school, never planned to get into marketing, thought I was going to be a screenwriter. I think you maybe tried your chops at that for a little bit. So we have that in common. Yeah. But I think we also both landed, I think, in the advertising world because we were in Hollywood. And, you know, Hollywood during the early days of Silicon Beach, Silicon Valley, whatever you want to call it, was kind of the perfect intersection of tech and the internet and celebrity culture and really storytelling, which has been, you know, your MO for the last handful of years at Shareability. So do you want to maybe walk us through some of the salient points that kind of amassed your resume to get you to where you are today, working with brands on helping them tell their story in a way that's more engaging than the traditional ad shop?
Yep. Sure. So definitely a non-traditional background. You know, probably the best place to start is, you know, laying on the hood of a car in a rodeo in Jackson, Wyoming, staring up at the sky going, something just got to, you know, something's got to change. I'm not on the right path. And so I saved up some money, did a year and a half walkabout around Southeast Asia and Thailand and India, worked with Mother Teresa, lived in a monastery, you know, wandered around the jungles of Borneo, and all of those things kind of contributed to this weird skill set that has kind of led me to where I am today. You know, there was a desire to be of service that led me into a world of nonprofit work, environmental, human rights work, kind of, you know, in the Greenpeace, nonviolent civil disobedience world. You know, how do you make a lot of noise with very little budget? Mm. How do you get on the front page of newspapers when you're going against a Home Depot, for example, and trying to get them to stop selling endangered, you know, woods from forest. Mm. And so this kind of weird marketing mindset of, you know, how do you appeal to a passionate community? How do you do it in a kind of scrappy way? And how do you do things that are, you know, meaningful and purpose driven? Because a lot of times, as you know, that's what people care about. And so those all kind of fed into this path that unfolded from the nonprofit world into working with a big publicly traded financial services company, helping them figure out how to be more effective with their CSR work and their purpose work, and to be the eyes and ears for what this whole web thing was.
Yeah.
You know, so this was like 2003. Mm-hmm. And so I had this, you know, unique opportunity to be the eyes and ears of the CEO, of a bank that had 5,000 employees. I didn't know the first thing about finance or banking. And I got paid to go to all the conferences and meet people and explore opportunities. And, you know, then this thing called Web 2.0 started to come around. And, you know, then next thing you know, you've got Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. And so I was very early days in all of that. And, you know, then launched the first social media week in Los Angeles. That was back in 2010. And, you know, started working with startups like where you and I met.
Right. Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, if I think about some of those early campaigns that we worked on from the media perspective, you've given a lot of commentary on campaigns that have like big view counts, low engagement rate, which is kind of a, you know, sure tell way of spotting, you know, a campaign that was lots of paid media, not a lot of organic traction. Yeah. But yeah, we got to see kind of the front row seat to some of those early, let's call them viral successes, like Apes with an AK-47, you know, that Mechanism did for Fox, or Uncle Drew, you know, was a fun one that I remember we always, you know, when people wanted to see kind of the viral hits playbook, you know, those were a couple of that I always had in my back pocket to show clients. Yeah. And then,
I don't know if you even know that we put some money behind the Dollar Shave Club video that.
Oh, yeah. I was actually just going to mention that, too. I didn't remember or know that we had anything to do with that.
Yep.
But back in the day, you could actually click the YouTube traffic source, you know, drop down, and you could actually see where the seating traffic was coming from. And I knew that, I think Giant got a little bit of money to promote that one too, which was in the competitive set back in the video seeding days.
Yep.
But yeah, you figure, right? Like you put that kind of love into production and creating an asset that you know is designed for some earned media, you know, without a good PR strategy and without a good paid media strategy. And I would say probably an important element is also like, what's your creator strategy, right? Like, are you thinking of including people in the video that have the opportunity to share it through their own channels in a way that's authentic, that isn't just, I think Facebook's pretty much banned you from sharing a video that you don't star in or that you don't have something to do with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, because that was more effective and more engaging than buying their media product. So they had to shut that down pretty fast.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember like some of those mashups too, like the Snoop Dogg Hot Pockets video where it was like, you know, Toby Turner from the gaming community, and then you've got Snoop Dogg, and then you've got like some Fly Girls from the WWE and John Cena, and, you know, all these different people, which kind of gave it a good, you know, not only did it make the creative interesting, but it also gave you a group of kind of social advocates that can get out there, do PR, and most importantly, share the video on social.
Yeah, and not to jump, you know, all over the place and jump to the present in some ways, sure. But you know, one of the things that defines shareability's work these days, and where we've been showing a ton of success as a strategy partner in particular, right? So, you know, we're the lead strategy partner for YouTube right now for their influencer work. And by strategy, that means we don't need to be the ones executing the campaigns, although we do a lot of them. But the strategy side is really become the most important thing in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. right? And one of the key things that we lean into is understanding the nuances of these niche audiences. And so when you describe a campaign like that one, where you've got Snoop over here and you've got a gamer over here, right? They are all very distinct audiences. And when you drill down into those, you can identify the right influencers who serve them, and you can design the right content for them. And so we always talk about, you know, most folks are going wide, an inch deep and a mile wide. That can be an effective strategy, but it's not as effective as combining that or going deep into these niche audiences, right? And understanding the nuances of those niche audiences. So back in the day when we go after different talent like that and include them, we've really built on that now and really kind of honed in on the understanding of the audience at a really deep level as a sort of key element to creating the engagement and the virality.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love the idea of kind of these overlapping affinities, right? I think of it a lot today as, you know, the intersection for direct consumer brands. You look at the success that Vuori has had based out of San Diego, right? Like they're basically Lululemon for Southern Californians, you know, like Lululemon was a first mover. Great. Like pump for them. But they're from Canada and, you know, Lululemon's from Southern California and it's aspirational because it's kind of a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more beach, a little bit more surf. So if you're a surfer, like I actually fought the activewear, you know, whole thing like in the Lululemon days because I didn't think it was very masculine. I was like, oh, that's yoga pants. That's for chicks, right? Right. So my wife bought me some Lululemon t-shirts, which are actually really great. And I still have them. They're a great product. But from a branding perspective, I just never thought that was something that guys would wear. And then, you know, the joint economic forces of COVID keeping everybody, you know, home and in pajamas, along with a brand like Vuori that pops up that kind of appeals to a guy like me who's into surfing and is, you know, more attracted to that skate, you know, Southern California lifestyle. Well, now you've hit kind of, okay, if you're Southern California surf relevant, that's one audience. And then you've got active wear over here. But if you can hit the people in the middle, like me, that basically identify with both of those affinities, then that's like your power middle. That's going to be your super buyer, your super customer, and your super advocate.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. No, I love that. So would you talk, you've talked a lot in press and in other interviews about the idea that brands need to entertain versus interrupt. And I would also say, you know, they need to entertain, they need to inspire, they need to educate. There's a lot of things that they can do other than interrupt, but they absolutely need to stop interrupting. Yeah. So will you expand a little bit on kind of what that means?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were talking about videos from the past that, quote, went viral because they got a nice paid boost and all of a sudden, you know, it was like a little snowball that you push down the hill and it started to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, right? That doesn't happen if it's shitty content.
Right.
And you can put, you know, enough money behind a video that is paint drying on a wall and get 100 million views. And that vanity metric used to look pretty good until, you know, as you know, you start to realize nobody liked it or cared. nobody commented, shared it, or whatever, unless they were like, why am I watching this? Thumbs down. And so, you know, at the most basic level, you know, if you want something to have any traction, it has to be entertaining. And, you know, we've done a lot of work with Mars over the years, and, you know, they've got a ton of brands. And there's what I call there's a money slide, I call it, right? And there's four different videos. And one was this kind of highly polished and highly produced agency video that went on TikTok. And then at the other end of the spectrum was content that was very native to the platform, lo-fi, but funny and engaging. It was on trend. It wasn't cringe on trend, but it was actually on trend. And they put the same amount of paid media behind all four videos. And so it was like a real A/B test, and the highly produced, non-entertaining one got like 3 or 4 million views and a bunch, you know, handful of engagements. On the other end of this, you know, spectrum, it was like 200 million views and hundreds of thousands of engagements, right? So purely from a media efficiency point of view, it's proving itself out, right? The better content, the more entertaining content, gets you a more efficient buy, right? Your cost per view goes down, your cost per engagement goes down. So you've just got that to think about. Then if you want anyone to pay attention to you, it has to be entertaining. If you want them to share something with, you know, their friends or family, it's got to be valuable, whether it's pure entertainment or educational or inspiring. And then if you want them to take action, right, it's got to have all of those things too. So, you know, it's a bit outdated almost to say that advertising sucks, you know, unless it's good content, but it's true and everybody knows it. It's like, oh, here's another crappy ad that I have to sit through versus, oh, that was actually really funny, or that actually made me feel something, or that gave me a little jolt of inspiration or showed me something I didn't know. So I think you look at it through different lenses, right? The paid media kind of efficiency side, how big is the snowball that you're pushing down the hill? And then purely from engagement and driving action, it's essential. And by the way, it drives brand love at the end of the day, like giving something that someone values that increases, you know, the opportunity for them to care about your brand.
Yeah, no, I love that. You know, something that I've identified when I was doing the research was you guys are very insight driven and very trend driven. I was reading up on your submission to the Shorty Awards for some work that you did with one of the big cell phone providers. I'm maybe not remembering what brand it was for off the top of my head, but you created some really cool content with Michael Cena, I believe, John Cena. Yep. Yeah. And it was, you guys had identified that, you know, photo bombing was something that was like kind of, you know, going viral, people jumping into other people's photos.
Yeah.
So can you talk about how important it is on kind of identifying that social trend or that insight, like the base point of the idea? You know, where, how do you guys go about that process of figuring out like what's the insight, what's the trend, what's kind of the core concept that you're going to start building, you know, the storyline, the cast, the stunt, all the other components around?
Yeah, so there's kind of two elements, right? One is if you're creating the campaign itself, right? And so we have a content studio where we make stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we're trying to come up with ideas, we're trying to find that insight, right? That one thing that the audience wants that they might not know they want, right? And then on the other side, which is the consultancy and the strategy work that we do, we may be given a campaign, right? Like, so YouTube may say to us, hey, we've got this big Dua Lipa campaign that we're going to be doing. We need it to perform as well as possible. How are we going to do that? Mm. Right? Which influencers should we choose? How can we, you know, provide the influencers with the right creative briefs? How can we provide, you know, the internal studio team with the right briefs? And so they're kind of different but related. On the former, where we may need to find an idea, you know, we did a couple John Cena videos. The first one blew up the internet and it was hundreds of millions of views. And we found this subreddit, and it was the unexpected John Cena subreddit. And all it was like 30,000 people who posted memes with the John Cena walkout music. Dun, 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 dun. And it would be like him jumping on, you know, SpongeBob or something. And so the insight was, well, that's a meme. What if we brought that meme to life? And we made this video of John Cena breaking through, you know, a barrier in a Cricket wireless store and surprising people. And we did that. And it, you know, it hit number one on Reddit, on the main page of Reddit as an app.
Wow.
Never happens.
Yeah.
And the subreddit said, we're done. Like, you know, they just brought this meme to life. Like, we should just close up shop. Subreddit. Okay. And then, you know, that topped the YouTube ads leaderboard for 3 months running, which had never happened. And then a year later, Cricket Wireless was the brand. They said, can you do it again? We got John Cena again. And we were like, whoa, okay, that's tough. And so we flipped the script. And the insight was, of everybody in the world, the person that has done the most make-a-wishes is John Cena.
Wow.
Right? And so he's done like 500 Make-A-Wishes. And surprisingly, the number two on the list was Justin Bieber, which I never
guessed. Interesting.
So we flipped the script and we did this thing. John Cena had no idea because we were doing four other videos at the same shoot. And we said, hey, John, do you mind just like reading some of these fan letters in front of the camera? And he started reading these letters and it was like, John, you changed my life and da, da, da. And, you know, you're such an inspiration. And, you know, it was like really emotional. And he was reading these things. And then he started reading this one and it was from a kid whose mother had breast cancer. And he was like getting emotional. And as he's reading it, this kid breaks through the wall and he gets startled. And all of a sudden he's like, the kid comes over and hugs the kid and John Cena cries. And it was all real and it was all authentic. And it became the most shared ad in the world by an order of magnitude. Like we took the other nine from the viral ad age list and the number of shares didn't add up to one video.
That's wild.
And so each of those was based on an insight that drove the creative. It drove everything about how we created the video and how we then promoted the video. It's the same thing with Cristiano Ronaldo, who's the number one social influencer in the world. And we made a video that in the first 12 hours hit 30 million views. And it was, we put him dressed kind of as a homeless guy in a square. And the audience had never seen him outside of being the guy who scores the winning goal or oiled up in like a Greek god on the cover of GQ or getting in his private jet. And so we did four videos of Ronaldo's. There was number one, two, three, and four videos, and they were all like Ronaldo in real life. And so it was this insight, like no one's ever seen him like that, but they really want to. Right. So it was like finding insights like that. The Dua Lipa New Rules video that we did that's now like 3 billion views. It was like, hey, let's pick this song about girl power because we think that's what her audience is most interested in, right? So the New Rules song is all about girl power. So it's like finding that gem, right? It's a bit of math and it's a bit of magic. Like you're looking at the data, but you're also exploring the kind of, you know, corners of the internet to see what you can come up with. And on the strategy side, it's going back to kind of what I was talking about of understanding the nuances of these niche audiences and the crossover affinities and, you know, going after not just K-pop fans for a Blackpink campaign, but, you know, all these subgenres and niches that are adjacent. Like we found gamers that were really into Blackpink. So we created a whole cadre of gaming influencers and then influencers that were really into dance challenges because we thought that was relevant for K-pop. So, you know, the insights and the data is qualitative, but it's also kind of got that magical kind of internet savvy element that needs to be part of it. Like all our most creative and strategic people are like pop culture junkies who just live and breathe, you know, everything social.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Neil Patel had a quote that the riches are in the niches, you know, so I think, and that's true. I mean, if you can get something that resonates with a niche audience, that can sometimes be a force multiplier on the engagement level and the sharing level and the word of mouth level more than, you know, something that would creatively resonate with like a wider group of people. That kind of brings me to my next question. And I know we've kind of touched on it already, but you have a quote about a term that you call manufacturing virality. You know, I remember that was always something that people would come up and, you know, ask me in sales presentations at Channel Factory when I, you know, mistakenly showed them a case study with multiple tens of millions of views, like, right. Oh, how do I do that? You know, and the reality is, you know, you never want to promise a client that, or at least I wouldn't. I felt over the years that there were kind of three elements that at least gave you the best possible shot. And I used to actually structure, like anytime I had to talk in public, I would structure a talk on these three elements. And one would be, you know, get them to cry. The second would be get them to laugh. And then the third would be get them to ask, was that real? Was what I just watched real, right? We get them to question reality essentially.
Yeah.
But those are obviously big broad, you know, directional forces that you can try and lean into them. You know, some brands do it better than other. The worst is when you try and make something funny and it doesn't land, right? Yeah. But can you talk about some of the other elements of manufacturing virality?
Yeah, I mean, we would always, you know, talk about guaranteeing that we were going to give them much higher engagement than they would ever, you know, be used to. And we would never guarantee virality. But we would say we're going to give you a whole lot better chance than you would by creating an ad or by going down a traditional road. And so for us, the elements that would allow us to position ourselves for as much success as possible were really the process itself, right? And so starting with the data and the insights, right? That qualitative data, that quantitative data. So starting with what we would call kind of creative intelligence or social intelligence, right? We don't want to just jump in. We want to like understand what the audience wants. We want to like look at it like a bullseye and say, cool, we might be relevant for these outer circles, but we want to get to the heart of that bullseye. And by doing so, it will appeal to all of the sort of circles, right? So you didn't need to know who John Cena was as a wrestler or as an actor to find the videos we did with him really freaking funny, but also really heartwarming, make you cry with the second one. So the process for us starts with the data and the insights. And then from that data and from those insights, then we kind of start to develop a strategy for how's it going to come to life. And the story world is sort of the framework that we use. And the story world becomes the well from where all the creative ideas that we start playing with come from. And so the creative well always tries to tap into what we'd call shareable emotions, right? So you mentioned two of them, you know, make you cry, make you laugh, you know, but there's also like awe and wonder, you know, things that people feel that they then feel compelled to share. And then once we kind of have ideas, then it becomes, okay, how do you orient those ideas and craft them for the platform that you're going after, right? So an idea is not going to just take shape for every platform. So is this a TikTok campaign, or back in the day, was this a Facebook campaign, or is it a YouTube campaign, right? And how is the platform going to influence the development of the idea? Mm. And meanwhile, we're always thinking about how are we going to promote this thing? Is it just going to be paid? Is it going to be other talent, influencers, right? So that sort of soup to nuts from data and insights all the way to distribution was always something that we would be thinking about. One of the pieces that we've now started to develop, which I think is really cool, is what we call trend engineering. Mm. So it's looking at a trend and reverse engineering how that trend happened, right? Because it's not a straight line. So it's like, okay, so-and-so did it here, and then this group over here, you know, copied it, but in their own way. And that inspired this group over here. And then that went to two different groups at the same time. And then then the brand jumped in again here. And then they dropped three influencers. And then this group and this group and this group. And you can actually watch the evolution of the trend. And you can say, okay, you know, Meghan Trainor, her last campaign that kind of went viral, it hit all these beats. And so when we're going to launch our next campaign, what can we learn from that trend and now start to engineer that trend? So how do we manufacture success by looking backwards at something that worked, right? You can't copy it, you know, obviously, because it's a different campaign. So if you start layering all these different elements together, now you're starting to think about manufacturing for a success. And at the very least, you know, you're going to be making something that's engaging, and it's always going to be higher than the benchmarks, which are generally crap.
Yeah. And you were alluding to this a little bit, but in Brendan Kane's book, you had a quote saying that efficient paid is the new organic. I love that. You know, I mean, how many videos have we seen over the years that were really great, but never quite got the, you know, the never found the audience they deserved because some great creator, you know, made something, but there wasn't a thought, there wasn't a thoughtful plan on how to get the initial eyes that would be required to get groundswell. So can you talk about that idea of making sure that you have an efficient paid media plan or an efficient distribution plan?
I mean, going back to the early days of Shareability, and this was informed by, you know, the work that we had done together and video promotion and distribution in general, you know, and I think most media agencies still generally do this. It's that kind of mass general kind of promotion. Right. And so when we were, you know, trying to ignite a video, we would have a very, very unique way of launching that video. Right. We would be testing out dozens of different audiences with paid media and very quickly seeing which ones were resonating the most, which ones were engaging the most. And then we put a lot of fuel behind those audiences. Right. And so we called that kind of our ignition strategy. And nobody else was doing that. You know, the big media companies weren't doing it. And they, you know, we would always, I can't say require, but really encourage the brands that we were working with directly to make sure they gave us some budget for paid media. Because we had a real special sauce for igniting this type of content, right? Versus just letting it pace out over time, which you can still do, but you needed to understand, like, how do you get it into the algorithms? Like, how do you get it so that the algorithms recognize this is something worthy of a bigger audience? And so you have kind of specific paid strategies, but then, you know, as I was mentioning before, if you've got polished content and you've got really highly engaging, socially native type of content built for that platform, and you're putting the same amount of spend behind those, you're going to get much better results. You're going to get more efficient paid because you have engaging content.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, some very senior execs at some really big companies still struggle to, you know, embrace that. They're like, well, what is the value of engagement and engaging content? And it's like, well, it's going to give you really highly efficient paid media. Like, how's that? Just at a pure dollar and cents kind of, you know, perspective.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I want to pivot to the work that you're doing with Down Home and Tim McGraw. I thought that was a pretty exciting partnership with the aim that you mentioned to kind of create compelling stories and content for the heartland of America. And feel like that's occasionally an audience that, you know, traditional Hollywood and maybe the coasts maybe ignore. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? Like, I don't know if people expected a show about cattle ranchers in Montana to become the ultimate, you know, most watched show on television with Yellowstone and all the derivatives of, and Tim McGraw being a big part of the star power behind one of those spinoffs. Would you talk a little bit about that venture? Anything that you can talk about? Content that's in the pipeline or projects that are coming through that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big one for us, right? This is our big swing for the fences, and it couldn't be more exciting. So we started working with the McGraw team about 4 years ago, and, you know, talk about understanding an artist and, you know, a brand, an iconic brand, which is Tim McGraw, and helping him be relevant or more relevant on social, right? That was kind of where we started. And, you know, we got to the point with him where he was getting duetted more on TikTok than Billie Eilish and Taylor Swift.
Wow.
Right. And this is, you know, 50 plus year old dude. And, you know, and it was because we were really helping them, you know, think about the platform and the audience, which is different than his traditional audience and the way that he would normally kind of show up. And really what it did is it built a lot of trust between us and his team. And then we saw, you know, Hello Sunshine sell for $900 million with Reese Witherspoon. And we saw LeBron Spring Hill Company valued at $700 million. And, you know, they were serving a specific audience, right? You had Reese and women, you had LeBron and urban culture. And we saw the Yellowstone effect. And we thought that the heart of America was an underserved but massively important market and audience that most people just considered the flyover states. And we thought it's not an audience that's actually geographically or even demographically defined. It's an audience that's really defined by values. And the values that Tim McGraw really embraces, we believed were the values that most Americans embrace, which is love your neighbor. And that the media storm around polarization and this extreme is actually not the whole story. And in fact, it's a smaller story than the fact that most people, when they need to, come together. And this idea of, you know, when you've got crazy Uncle Bob, you know, arguing with crazy Aunt Jane, it's like, hey, you know what? Why don't you guys take it outside? Right. And so this value is what really drove the creation of Down Home. And we saw this big opportunity where most entertainment and most brand marketing is coming from the coasts. And, you know, you can imagine, you know, you're the person who oversees the brand at Tropicana and you want to reach, call it wholesome moms, you know, who aren't shopping at Erewhon. And you also know that the person in the team that's leading that brand is most likely, you know, a coastal agency. And are they really speaking to wholesome moms, right? So you've got the brand universe, you've got the entertainment universe, film, television, you've got new brands that you can launch from that, you know, sort of platform of values. And so Down Home is really, you know, a media and entertainment company born from and for the heart of America. It's really not focused on geography and demographics, but on that sort of shared values of people connecting. And we've got some really big, exciting projects in the works. You know, sold a huge show to one of the biggest streamers in the world. We've got unscripted projects, we've got, you know, live event projects, we've got brands we're launching, and we've got a consultancy that will be powered by ShareAbility's, you know, engine essentially, and the expertise that we've developed with YouTube and Google in particular, which is, you know, really understanding the Gen Z audience and all the nuances of that Gen Z audience, taking that same methodology and same approach to that Down Home audience, that, you know, new American middle or that heart of America. So yeah, super exciting, game changer for us for sure.
Yeah, I think that's probably a strategic value, especially for brands that are trying to maybe swing back from, you know, stepping in minefields around this whole, like you mentioned, this polarization spectrum. Yeah. You feel like maybe, you know, Bud Light could use some of that secret sauce right about now.
And, you know, you mentioned Lululemon, actually. I often use Lululemon as an example of a brand that probably wants to be relevant beyond the coastal sort of mindset, right? They want to go to that next level of, okay, how do we appeal to, you know, people all over the country, right? And people that are not kind of living in that sort of coastal sort of mentality. And so how to help brands do that, right, will be a big part of the sort of brand side of Down Home, like using the data that we will, you know, be creating and pulling together, using the insights, you know, the know-how of the McGraw audience that's been doing this successfully for 30 plus years, the know-how of ShareAbility. And then our third partner, which is Skydance, and, you know, David Ellison, you know, Skydance has the Hollywood heft of doing this for the biggest titles in the world, you know, Top Gun, Mission Impossible. So they know how to appeal to this audience at that level. So if you take those three elements, right, McGraw's credibility and 30 years of appealing to that audience, Skydance's Hollywood heft and shareability's sort of secret sauce, math and magic of insights and audience, it's a pretty potent combo.
Yeah, sounds pretty exciting. Well, can't wait till you guys can talk more officially about what's coming down the pipeline. I know in that world, nothing moves fast, but yeah, it'll be exciting to hear more about.
Yeah, it's happening. We're going into production in August. It's a big
wow. Well, we need more I feel like the only good channel worth watching right now is Apple TV, in my opinion. Everybody else is extremely backed up from all of the tumult we've had over the last few years with COVID and writer strikes and all the like. But well, cool. Well, I want to get a little bit into, you know, kind of your management philosophy a little bit, because I found some things that were very interesting, appealing, some cool quotes. One was kind of a mantra around the way that you approach business development, which I thought was really refreshing. And it was kind of from the mindset of like abundance and not being desperate, not being a desperate sales guy and a business development guy. You said, I don't chase, I attract things to me, and the things that need to will find me. I might have butchered that a little bit, but I think that's a good philosophy. You know, I think sometimes salespeople, business development people, we can be too aggressive, too persistent in the follow-up. And sometimes I definitely kind of, you know, apply things the same way. And my philosophy is, you know, the world is vast. There's another client out there under a rock somewhere. I just need to turn over enough rocks. And ultimately, why chase the people that are either not responding or are negatively responding to you? You know, go find people that look and feel like you, that you want to spend time with. And I think that, you know, you have to have some degree of follow-up and important, you know, once you've sent a proposal or something like that. But I thought that was that's good advice to salespeople in general. The idea that, you know, operate from a place of abundance versus, you know, kind of chasing down every opportunity. So love to hear more about that.
I mean, look, that's an aspirational mindset for me. And I think probably for a lot of people, you know, there's the reality of I got to close some business. And so what do you need to do to close the business can really kind of put a flame under your ass sometimes to like, I gotta hunt, right? And, you know, I'm always aspiring to attract the business, right? And, you know, I think what you do is really inspirational, right? You're putting yourself out there, you're creating kind of valuable content, you know, thought leadership, right? So more and more people go, oh, this Dylan, what's he up to? Oh, influencer, you know, promotion and strategy. Let me learn more. Like that can come in, right? Some of our biggest work has come in because someone's like, oh, I read about you in Brendan Kane's book and I've seen this. And it's like, cool, that's awesome. So that's the gold, right? At the end of the day, where you're a thought leader creating stuff. There's a guy, Blair Enns, I think, who, you know, Win Without Pitching. Love his content. Really, it's awesome, right? And the idea of win without pitching as an agency or as a consultancy is so aspirational, right? Oh, what does that mean? Well, it means that you're coming to a conversation as an expert, and they're just as lucky to have you as you are to have them. And so it's much more about like a blind date of like, is this the right fit? Right? Are we going to be able to provide the value that you need? And are you going to be the right partner for us so that we can do what we do best? And so I think that's another piece to the mindset, you know, so going out and getting introductions and getting referrals. I mean, referrals, as you know, are the gold. Mm-hmm. How do you cultivate a referral network? How do you get other people telling their friends or colleagues, oh, you got to talk to Dylan, right? Or you've got to talk to Eric. Trust me, you know, they do amazing work. And then you want to be going into that conversation with, you know, the opposite of the begging bowl, which is, you know, the, hey, our company is really strong at these things. What do you need? Like, tell me what you need. And when I hear that someone needs something that I truly believe we can provide for them, then I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, this could be a great fit. Now, are we in your budget range, right? Are we, you know, are we gonna be the right partner for you for a variety of other reasons? So, yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, an abundance mindset is what I aspire to. Like everybody else, there are times where I'm like, you know, and you want to chase them and that person hasn't replied to your third email and you're like, really? It was such a great meeting. You wanted to introduce me to your wife and your friends and your family and have me over for dinner and bring me up to the CEO. And now you won't reply to my emails. It's like,
yeah, no, that's great. I want to get in a little bit more into your personal philosophy. And I think, you know, our personalities dictate how we show up at work too. But one excerpt that I read was you one time were literally, you know, thinking of a specific speaker that you wanted to book for Social Media Week, I think.
Yeah.
And you were at a kid's birthday party at the W Hotel, having a margarita with like a fake lizard tattoo on your neck. And the guy literally walked into the room and like,
as I was talking on the phone to my buddy about how are we going to get a hold of, how are we going to get a hold of Sir Ken Robinson? Do you know anyone? How are we going to get him? And I looked up and he walked in and I just, mind was blown.
Well, I think that really plays into that abundance mentality, but also that, you know, power of manifestation. And I remember the cigar lounge that I hang out in when I'm in Los Angeles is called the Cuban Seed. It's on Sunset Boulevard in between the Roxy and the Viper Room, across the street from the Viper Room. And it's where I pretty much spend most evenings if I'm in LA. And I remember one time we were just talking about The Sopranos, just in the cigar lounge, just going hard on Sopranos, and James Gandolfini walks in at that moment and buys some cigars. And we were just like, holy cow. Like you can't tell me that there's, you know, a power greater than us in the universe when things like that happen.
Look, at the, you know, we talk about, you know, in work, math and magic, you know, and, you know, some would call it art and science, whatever. But to me, magic, you know, is just sort of that, you know, cultivation or that ability to kind of be in the flow, whatever that may mean. And so magic, I think, sometimes equates to magnetism. And, you know, building a culture, for example, at a company is really, really important.
Mm.
And one thing that's always, you know, been such a sort of source of pride is when clients are like, I don't know what it is about your team, man, but it is fun working with you guys. And, you know, I just like your people and they care and they're kind. And, you know, those soft skills and emotional intelligence, right, I think are so often undervalued. And, you know, look, the moments that we're talking about where Sir Ken shows up, where I'm talking about him, or, you know, Gandolfini shows up when you're talking about him, we all want more of those. And that is true magic when that happens.
Right.
And it's just so fun and so incredible. But I think there's a sort of a click down into magic that is much more about like culture by design and life by design, which is, you know, how do you focus on the things that you know are most important, right? How do you focus on the values that you know lead to a more meaningful life?
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I think you get surprised that the people that are around you, you're like, how did we end up with all these freaking cool people at this company? Like, everybody here is someone I like. And we've, you know, we're like 40, 45 people. And it's like, they're all good people.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
same reason I've stayed with Jess for 8 years, even when the recruiters come knocking. You know, it's not often that you find a boss that becomes more of a partner and gives you a lot of rope because she trusts you. But yeah, just, and leads from a position of like, there's no ego. We're just here to show up, do good work for clients, and most importantly, get out of the office and live our lives with our kids and our families and our loved ones. Like, work is not life. I mean, I am guilty of being a workaholic because I do love it and I'm coin operated.
Right.
It definitely really helps when you show up and your team is a pleasure versus a pain to work with.
It's huge. I mean, it's like, it's the difference between an energy injection and an energy drain. And we all know it from our personal lives. It's like, if you're having an argument with your spouse or something, it's just like, it sucks the life out of you. It's like everything gets, you know, colored differently. And so if that's your world on the day to day, man, time to change things up.
For sure. I was reminded that you have been an avid Toastmaster for a long time. And I was also reminded about the time when, you know, you and I both went up to the Pepsi brand summit in San Francisco, and I got to see you in action, like from stage in our pitch fest. And I was just so blown away. And obviously the audience was as well when we ended up winning that pitch fest. Obviously, you've spent a lot of time preparing from the perspective of being like really good being on stage and speaking to a room of people, which, as we know, I think the average American says that they would rather, you know, die, like literally be killed than speak to a room of people. But was that a natural instinct that you had, or was Toastmasters really a place where you could go and refine that skill set and get really good at it?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? You know, for whatever reason, I tend to put in my bios that I'm an advocate for class clowns. And, you know, and I think it's partly because I was a bit of a class clown. And I think, you know, I'm sure it was partly that I liked attention, but I think it was also partly like, man, this class is freaking boring. Like, everyone looks bored. Like, let's have more fun, right? Like, this is not supposed to be boring. This is life. Like, how do we, you know, how do we laugh? How do we have fun? So there's like a desire for a group of people to have the energy rise. Like, I have that desire in me to like have the people I'm around, you know, to be having more fun and to be enjoying themselves. And so I think there's a bit of that kind of naturally, you know, inside. Toastmasters, I couldn't recommend it more. I haven't been for years. But it's like the only opportunity to just practice getting up in front of people in a no stakes environment where everyone is there to support you. And, you know, I just remember, you know, it's a very structured, you know, meeting, and it's dirt cheap. And so there's literally no excuse for anyone not to do it. But it's like, it's very structured, right? And one of them is this thing called table talks, where everyone gets up in front of the whole group. And I think it's like 2 minutes or something. And you get asked a random question. And it may be under a thematic, but it could be like, hey, Eric, tell us about, you know, what it was like to invent the Oreo cookie and have it go so big, right? And you have 2 minutes to answer. So it's a bit like an improv.
Yeah, I was going to say, that right? Sounds like, you know, yeah, improv a little bit. Yeah.
But, and if you get hung up on like, well, this has to sound credible, and you're screwed. Mm-hmm. Right. But if you just go with it and all of a sudden you're just, you know, kind of riffing and so on, like, that is such an amazing opportunity to practice being in front of a room, getting a tough question, you know, forgetting your lines, but needing to talk or whatever it may be. And then they have opportunities to practice a speech. Like, they have all these kind of predefined formats. And then they have the opportunity to critique a speech, which is actually challenging. Like, okay, you've got 3 minutes to give a critique of that person's speech. And so, you know, it can be people that are terrified of public speaking. It can be people that English is not their first language. It can be people that just want to up their skill to be able to present in a room at their office or present on Zoom to a prospect or get up on stage and give a speech or do a speech at a wedding, whatever it is, right? It gives you the opportunity to practice.
Yeah.
So it's massively valuable.
Yeah, I think that's so important, especially in this day and age where the opportunity for business development people, I think they don't get the reps that, you know, I mean, I worked in a boiler room at one point in my career. You know, we were selling investment opportunities to attorneys to invest in a movie that we were producing that was about famous court cases. So we dialed 100 attorneys a day. We figured out how to break through to maybe 30 of them. We got 10 of them to take an investment portfolio package, and then maybe we closed one. And it was strictly a numbers game. But what was really exciting about it is that you got to go head to head with, you know, someone of high intellectual capital. And, you know, get whatever you think about attorneys, love them or hate them, they're usually smart people. They invested some time and effort to get to where they were, and they're notoriously hard to get on the phone, and their time is literally money. Like, they bill $500 to $600 to $700 an hour. So you had to basically, the same way that you have to hook somebody with TrueView or TikTok in the first 5 seconds, you had to do the same thing. And generally we would open them up with humor. Like, we'd be like, Bob, the best intellectual property attorney Jones, you know, or something like that, just enough to get a chuckle out of them. And then you knew you could like go hit them with the pitch. But I think in this environment today where business development reps are really, you know, keyboard commandos with AI tools at their fingertips, it's hard to get people on the phone because everybody's on cell phones now, and they don't really answer the phone unless it's somebody that they know. So I actually feel bad for this next generation of sales and business development people who are coming up, because they don't have those formative jobs that gave them the reps to basically just think 5 seconds ahead of your own brain and be able to like improv and come up with things in a meeting and sound credible, even if you're kind of, you know, working out the ideas in real time in your head. And it feels like what you were talking about with Toastmasters, especially the improv portions, really sharpen those skills of being able to like talk on your feet.
And by the way, you know, I agree with you. I do not envy the future of trying to do cold outreach. I mean, it's really tough, right? And so, okay, well, what are the alternatives, right? So, you know, it is that magnetic kind of attractive thought leadership and so on. I think it's really important to build your network and really try to figure out how to get referrals, right, from people that know you and like you and trust you. And then I think there's also just incredible value of just trying to get out and about, especially as you're younger, and trying to establish a network and really learning this sort of interpersonal skills that allow you to sort of thrive in a social setting, right? Where you're not the guy passing out business cards going, oh, hey, my name's Eric. Let me tell you a little bit about myself and the work I do and why you should, you know, work with me. And, you know, the absolute opposite approach of like, you know, listening and asking questions and just trying to be helpful. And how can I help you? You know, where it's not even bringing up your business a lot of the time. And, you know, that mentality, I think, is really important. There's a great book called The Go-Giver, which is just right, cultivating that mindset of be of service, give, you know, and then don't worry, it'll come back to you.
Yeah, I love it. Well, great reminders and some of those core lessons of, you know, operate from a perspective of generosity. But yeah, I think, you know, we got to get out there and get into the real world as often as possible. You know, COVID was fun. We got to stay home for a few years. I've actually put out a challenge on my LinkedIn. I'm doing 30 networking events in 30 days.
Wow.
And I don't care if it's a chamber of commerce meeting or a leads group or whatever. I'm just getting out there and talking to people because I'm tired of, you know, sitting here in my pajamas half dressed from the waist up. And, you know, this podcast is great. It's awesome to get to do it with people like you who I have history with, and I already have the chemistry. Some of the research process builds that up. You know, sometimes sometimes I can watch enough videos and listen to enough podcasts and read enough articles about a new person and never do show prep with them, where I almost can transfer that feeling of knowing them from the research, and it shows up in the interview. But it's always, you know, much better if there's at least a period or some position of familiarity or history. Well, hey, man, I've had you locked up here for almost an hour now, so I think it's probably getting to the point where we can land the plane. But why don't I leave you with some final thoughts on what are you most excited about at the work that you're doing at ShareAbility for, say, the next 6 months to a year? You know, what's coming down the pipe that you're really pumped about?
Yeah, I think it's going to be extending the strategic work that we're doing for YouTube and Google, and really building on that. You know, the foundation has been focused on Gen Z, right? Understanding all the nuances of Gen Z and helping YouTube and Google really serve that audience, which is obviously their core audience, and taking that approach and taking the methodologies and all the sort of expertise we've developed with probably the most incredible client you could ever hope for. I mean, talk about incredibly smart people who have unbelievable data, and they've pushed our team so far. So taking that to other clients, taking that to the down home world is really exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, I'm sure you're going to be doing some exciting things, and I'll be pumped to continue to follow along. Thanks again for coming on the show, man. Anything else you want to plug or point people in the direction of if they want to get in touch?
Nothing that I need to plug. I think, you know, I'm always down to talk with anybody. You know, sometimes people be like, I think this company is going to be too small for you guys, but would you be up for chatting with them? And I love doing that. I mean, that's the kind of the part of biz dev that I actually really enjoy. It's like talking to people, hearing what they're up to, what do they need? And if it's not going to be us, you know, our networks are big enough that we can point people in the right direction. So always down to do that. And I'm easy to get a hold of, you know, it's the letter E at shareability.com.
There you go. Well, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Eric. And for those of you who are following along at home, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you are watching or viewing or listening to the show. And also, if you leave us a review, that's how the show finds a larger audience organically. But most importantly, if you think you have a colleague or somebody out there who would benefit from the conversation that I had with Eric today, don't forget to share the show with them. So that being said, thanks again, man. Really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, appreciate you having me. Good to see you, man.
All right. We'll see you soon.
All right. Later.